Hello and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. First of all, I just want to say I hope everybody is doing well and as safe as can be during these perilous times. Unfortunately, as you all well know, there is no real baseball right now, so it gives more time for reading and watching videos and listening to music about baseball. So with that in mind, I hope to be able to bring these back again on a much more regular basis. As you may or may not know, I work at a supermarket these days, so I am considered an essential worker. Happen to be off Tuesdays and Wednesdays, which is when I try to do my interviews as best I can and work on them. Sometimes takes a little longer than others, like this one, which I originally recorded a few weeks ago. Unfortunately, I'm just getting around to putting it up now. So with that said, I am in my basement office right now, which is where I spend most of my time these days when I'm not working, having to separate myself from my wife, who is unfortunately immunocompromised due to an organ transplant she received a few years back. So I am at least surrounded by my baseball books, my cats, my dog, my TV, my bathroom, so I'm pretty much all set. If I had a refrigerator down here, I'd never have to leave, but it is giving me a chance to get back to some more baseball reading, so here we go with today's conversation. When I was a kid, I looked forward to another kind of opening day besides the one where the umpires yelled play ball for the first game of the season. For me, it was almost more important when the first boxes of Topps baseball cards came to my local candy store. One time I was so excited to buy an entire box, I didn't realize I had left my school-loaned violin under the counter until I arrived for class. At the early stages of my collecting in the mid-1960s, the cards came five in a pack, plus that customary thin slab of gum, all for a nickel. You could also get a slightly larger quantity of cards, I'm not sure if it was 15 or 25, wrapped in cellophane instead of wax for a little bit more. Now, I think I speak for a lot of kids when I say we never thought of the players as real people. I'm using air quotes for that. That is, guys who live normal lives, full of the situations and problems we all face at some point in life. To borrow from Tennyson, is it really better to have loved and lost, to have enjoyed playing baseball for a living, however well or short-lived the career, than never to have played at all? For many athletes, the heartbreak and absence of the cheering and adulation is difficult to bear. When you have to think about what to do with the rest of your life, just like the average Joe, when you were once a hero to thousands. Brad Baluchian gives us an inkling of what that's like in The Wax Pack, on the road, The Wax Pack, on the open road in search of baseball's afterlife. Baluchian started his collecting much later than I, but his feelings were just as strong. Not sure what instrument he might have played during his academic career. His book is a bittersweet story about, well, you'll have to listen to the conversation and read the book.
Brad Baluchian, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Ron. Appreciate you having me on.
So the book is based on your obtaining a wax pack, and for those who don't know what a wax pack is, those who are too young, the baseball cards, which used to be only put out by Topps, used to come in a pack literally made of waxy paper that was folded, as opposed to the aluminum foil almost these days, or the clear plastic these days. And you absolutely could not tell who you were going to get. These days, if you have a clear cellophane bag, at least you get to know who's on the top and who's on the bottom. But in those days, it was like pure chance. So I'm curious, which came first, buying the card and deciding to write the book, or deciding to write a book and just taking a chance on the players that came in the pack?
No, I definitely had the idea for the book first, and then I thought, I had this idea that a pack would be a perfect device to tell the story of these guys that, were my heroes as a kid. And I knew that what I loved about the pack was that it was, you know, you're going to get a random collection, and you're going to get a lot of guys, that were more of the bench warmer types, who, or the underdogs, who were the guys that I always liked the most as a kid. So I had the idea, I thought of, you know, the pack. I mean, I think the designers at the press did a great job with the design, because they made it look just like a pack of cards. And you think about, you know, there's about 15 cards in a pack, and there's maybe 15 chapters or so in a book. So it was the idea first, and then I said, okay, then now I need to get a pack and see who I'm going to write about.
Now, given who you did write about, do you think this would have turned out much differently with a different group of players?
It's a good question. I thought about that, because my first inclination would be to say yes, but then the more, or sort of as I started on the trip, but after doing the whole thing, I would say no. I think, you know, there were certain patterns that kept emerging as I got to meet these guys that I think have a lot to do with the generation that these guys are part of and the time they played in. And I think some of those patterns would probably ring true if, no matter what pack I used.
So you're saying that makes me think of an interesting follow-up. If you would go back and get an unopened pack from, let's say, the 1960s, you know, what would that generation be like?
And I think that's a fascinating experiment, where I think you would get differences. Like, you know, I've often thought, like, well, okay, what about the guys we watch play now? What if someone 30 years from now opens up a pack from 2020? And, you know, what's that going to mean? We know it's going to be different, right? Because these guys today, I mean, even the more, underdog type players are making pretty good money, you know, once they get past those first couple of years. So the money's changed, you know, our society's changed, our culture's changed. You would definitely get a different experience depending on the era you picked.
Was there anything these players in your book had in common? I mean, looking back on some of our old correspondence, I recall you once compared athletes to the classic book, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Do you still think that?
Uh-huh. Well, in terms of what things do these athletes of the era, of that era, what do they have in common?
Well, when we see videos of the players, and in our minds, these players are eternally young. And it must be a shock when you come to them, and they're now in their 50s and their 60s, and they're like regular people.
Right, and I think that, they all have age, and that's, you know, you have this difference, right, from what's in your mind, but you know, one of the take-home points of the book, and I think one of the really nice messages, is really that we all have a lot more in common with baseball players than we realize. Whether, you know, no matter whether we're talking about them when they were playing or now, in the sense, you and I couldn't hit a ball or throw a ball like that. But, you read this book, and one of my goals was to show the humanity of these players and to show that everybody has something. You know, everyone, you know, no matter how famous or successful you are, what a star baseball player you are, everyone's got some issue or issues they're dealing with. And they're not that different than the issues that you or I might deal with. I mean, they're about relationships, they're about, issues with parents, issues with kids, with spouses, healthier. Health, right, all these things, you know, addiction, there's no, you know, those things don't, you know, those things hit these players just as much as they hit us, if not more so, because of the spotlight that shined on them.
I think one of the differences you're talking about today and in the times when these players were active, I think when these players are active, it was just becoming, I don't know if acceptable is the right word, but prior, you would never write about a player's alcoholism or addiction to pills. Mm-hmm. And it just, in the 80s, this was starting to become fair game. And now, you know, everything's on Twitter. So, when you talk about, you know, somebody 20, 30 years from now writing about these guys, I think the concept of hero worship, the hero culture, has changed drastically over the past 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and I think that back in these guys' era, to show vulnerability or emotion was to show weakness, right? Unless it was positive emotion. I mean, to talk about your feelings, to talk about your issues or weaknesses, you know, that was not something that was encouraged or celebrated, and that's changed. And I think what what comes out in the book is that these guys are heroic for their vulnerability, especially because they were guys that played in that era. And now, you know, years later, the fact that they were willing to open up to me, a stranger, and talk about some of these things and to get emotional, that was the most impressive thing to me. That to me is more, that shows more strength and more courage than anything you can do on a baseball field.
And certainly, yes, the fact that they did open up to you so much was amazing. What was your process in approaching them?
Well, so one thing I did, I had done about a year of research before I took the trip, and this was really completely a passion project. I didn't have an advance. I didn't have any funding. This was just on my own. And again, I didn't have a background in sports writing, so it's not like I had any special connections to make this happen. So I spent about a year doing research about where they were and contacting them and trying to find them. And then I set out on the journey, which was over 11,000 miles of driving by myself over 7 weeks. And what I would do when I would meet a guy is I had a folder, like a manila folder, that was a really thick folder full of all the articles that I had printed out covering their career. And I would put it in front of them and say, I would start the conversation by saying, this is your whole career. I've read all these articles, and I feel like I know nothing about you.
Hmm.
And that, I think, caught them off guard a little bit and was unexpected, because most baseball books, most baseball writing is focused on the game, the heroics, the, you know, the on the field action. And I was basically saying, I'm not interested in that. That's all been written about. It's been documented. I want to know what your relationship was like with your dad or with your son. And that, I think, set the tone for, I also was willing to talk about my own life and my own story, and just, I didn't go in there just as a, you know, investigative journalist asking these hard questions. I would volunteer stuff about myself, and I think it's okay to do that as long as you're fully transparent in your writing about it, right? So when you read the book, you see I'm in the book, I'm a huge part of the book, but I also admit all of my biases and my my weaknesses, so I'm sort of giving full disclosure both to the reader and to the players as I interact.
And it is quite an accomplishment on your part to get them to open up to, like you say, you there are certain writers in the field who have reputations as sports writers, as baseball writers, and you, all due respect, had none. And yet they were still willing to open up to you like that is really amazing.
Well, and I wonder, maybe it worked to my advantage that I had none. I don't know, I'm just sort of spitballing here, but the fact that I approached it, I mean, I'm a biology professor. I teach at a community college in Oakland, California, and I would talk about that. I'd say, hey, you know, I'm not someone from the pack. I mean, by that I mean the media pack. You know, this is not my world. So maybe that kind of disarmed them. I don't know.
Yeah, because maybe the fact, that you weren't a in the field, so to speak, in the journalism field. I wonder what they thought, you know, like, is this like a crazed stalker fan, like, coming after me here?
But also, well, I mean, and I would try to anticipate that by saying, I know you might think I'm a crazed stalker fan, right? So for me, it's all about, openness, honesty, if you're just saying, hey, like, I'm not hiding anything. And that was part of the trust that I built with the players, was they told me stuff that I didn't put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But stuff that I know a lot of readers would have liked, right? But just because it makes for good reading doesn't mean you should put it in the book. And you know, stories or anecdotes that are juicy and fun as a baseball fan. But I always would ask myself as I went through my writing and editing process, does this serve the story? Is this relevant to what the story I'm telling? And if it's not, if it's just sensationalistic or it's just to share some dirt, then I didn't put it in there. Because I think that's where writers can go wrong, is, you know, if it's not in service of the greater meaning of your story, and you have to figure out what is your what is the meaning? And the best piece of advice I ever got about writing was from an editor at the LA Times. He said, you know, forget your fancy words and your, you know, your syntax and all that. The only thing that matters in writing is the meaning. And so whether you're writing a 200-word piece or a 400,000-word book, you should be able to summarize the meaning of your writing in one word or maybe two words. And to me, that was what I always, I would put a post-it next to my computer that had the meaning of the book on the wall. So if I ever started to wander, I'd say, nope, if it doesn't serve that, it doesn't belong in the book.
And it's interesting working with the publisher of your book is the University of Nebraska Press, as opposed to a larger press. I mean, certainly books have come out in the past where there are those juicy details, so to speak, and excerpts would focus on those to promote book sales. I mean, this is not one of those types of books. It's not going to be, I hope I'm not going to burst your bubble here, but it's not going to be in John Grisham or Stephen King territory. We every writer knows that pretty much, that they're not going to be the next Stephen King or John Grisham. But deciding to do that, I think, is a kindler, gentler way to bring these ball players to light. You had success with most of the players getting them, or there are a couple you had trouble with. And one of the players, Al Cowens, had passed away in the intervening years. And it would have been easy to excuse not doing a chapter on him, but you still included him. Why did you want to do that? Just for the sake of completion?
Well, I think just because someone is dead doesn't mean they don't have a story to tell. He is a fascinating character. The fact that he grew up in L.A. in Watts and during the race riots of the 60s, I mean, from a writer's perspective, I mean, just knowing the little that I knew about him in the beginning, that captivated me, right? The diversity of experience of these players, you know, you've got Al Cowens growing up in Watts and Compton versus Don Carmen growing up in Camargo, Oklahoma, in western Oklahoma, a town of 200 people. What an amazing contrast. And from a literary perspective, that is enticing to me as a writer to then go visit those places and tell those stories. But also the fact that as different as those guys were in their backgrounds, they ended up in the same place. What they have in common is they played this game at the highest level. So for Cowens, it was about going back, going to his high school. I met his cousin, who they all passed off as his brother when they were playing. I mean, Billy Cowens, his cousin, was in the book, who I met with. And they ran such a great ruse on that, saying that they were brothers, that when I met with Gary Templeton, he said, oh, yeah, I was actually roommates with Al's brother, Billy. I said, well, actually, you know, actually not his brother. He said, oh, really? Yeah. So talking to Billy, talking to Al Cowan's son, Purvis, going to his high school and happened to go to a reunion where, of his generation at the high school. That made for a really fun chapter and also a very serious chapter in parts to tell his story. And I thought it was a nice way to end the book.
Now, a number of these players had issues with their dads, some good, some bad. But the one that I'm thinking of right now is Doc Gooden's son, and how you had to deal with him. And he was Gooden was one of the players that you did not have a chance to have a face to face with, but you dealt with Doc Gooden Jr. And I'm wondering if you could. It might be unfair to ask, but get a sense of how he felt about his father, you know, having to be an apologist for him for all the times that he didn't show up for whatever reasons.
Well, I think I could best answer that question by just saying I don't think it's a cop out to say that if you read that chapter, I think you'll get a good sense of what Doc, Little Doc, as they call him, thinks about all that. Because I spent some time with Little Doc, and I think I tried to write that chapter to show sort of through Little Doc's eyes, based on what he said, what he didn't say, the burden of being Doc Gooden's son. And I think that Little Doc is a very upbeat, positive, energetic, likable guy, but there's a certain underlying sadness there with him that has a lot to do with how he was raised and his relationship with his father. So I just encourage people to read that chapter and how it ends, and I think you'll have an answer to that question.
I'm sorry, how old is little Doc?
I think he's what, in his early 30s now?
He is that old. Well, right. It gets hard to think of players that we watch now have kids of that age.
Right. right.
So this is obviously a very frank book. Other authors have written about meeting players, but without including that much of themselves as you did. Why did you decide to go that way, and did you find it difficult?
I did that. To me, I was never interested in not doing that, knowing that that would make it a harder book and a harder sell, and I would actually, and I already know, I mean, I've read comments from people that don't like that I did that. You know, they say, oh, well, why should we care about Brad Baluchin's OCD or, you know, too much information, you're oversharing, and I always knew that I would get pushback from that. But to me, the only way, and when I was actually trying to get a deal for the book, which was really difficult and took a long time, a lot of people in the industry, editors, agents, were strongly encouraging me not to include all that stuff. And they said, "Oh, stick to baseball. Don't put yourself in there." And I kept true to what I always believed was the vision of the book, which was that if I'm not in there, then the book, then it's not going to be the kind of book I wanted it to be, which is a book that's bigger than baseball, right? It's not just about baseball. It's actually not that much about baseball in a sense, because the challenge for me was always, how do you do this without it being 15 magazine profiles stapled together, right? And also, how do you get people interested in reading about Randy Reddy and Jaime Coconut? These were not big names. So to me, the only way as a writer, the only way to do that would be to have some connective tissue, some overarching quest that would keep the reader moving from chapter to chapter, and that would be me, right? That's my role as the narrator and a main character is to bridge all these guys together. And so I felt it necessary for me to be in the book. I also felt like it just makes for more compelling reading and has a broader audience if I talk about some of my own issues and my own struggles and how I can relate to these players. So the book becomes not just baseball, not just memoir, not just travel, but kind of all of those things. And the other reason is because, frankly, I think I'm a better writer when I do that. You know, a lot of very successful nonfiction writers don't want themselves in the story, but I'm a very open, honest, frank person, and to me as a writer doing that craft, I write better when I can be part of the story.
Did you try to get other publishers interested in this, or was UNP your first choice?
Oh, no, I had a long process where the reason why it took so long to get it published was because I had two different agents at different times that were out there trying to sell it to the big five publishers in New York. And they just couldn't, you know, got rejected over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Basically being told, you know, it's great writing and it's a great idea, but who are you? You don't have a platform. You don't have 100,000 Twitter followers. You know, again, not willing to take a risk, right? What I learned from the process is how, and it's really discouraging, how risk-averse the nonfiction book publishing industry is. And so, because, you know, I mean, this is a passion project, but I would like to be able to, you know, this is also my profession in addition to my teaching. So I would like to be able to get paid, you know, fairly for all the work. And, you know, and presses like University of Nebraska, it's been a great experience, but they just don't have the money to pay much in terms of advances. So, yeah, I had tried to go that route, and then I said, okay, well, do I quit or do I go to a smaller press or what? And that's when I ended up going to Nebraska.
Turning a little bit to the process, you undertook this expedition alone for the most part. How did you get through those long drives from city to city?
The podcast Serial, which I know sounds dated now as a reference, but you remember, people remember that podcast was just so compulsively it's very addictive. But no, I mean, I had a lot of, you know, podcasts, music. You know, I actually find driving can be pretty meditative. It did get long and it did get tiring at times, but I would try to also work in some days where I didn't have to drive too far.
Did you stop in like other tourist attractions along the way to break up the monotony?
A little bit. I did go to a couple of baseball games that I didn't put in the book. I visited with some old friends. I mean, that kind of cross-country trip is a great chance to catch up with people you haven't seen in a while. So, yeah, I would try. But it was also exhausting in the sense
sure.
that, I mean, we talked back then, and I was blogging every day about the road. I was taking pictures. I mean, I would go home, and I would have, you know, hundreds of pages of notes that I would collect. So it was no vacation. When I was in the hotel or wherever I was staying, imagine, you know, you've met with these guys. Now you have to capture all that. So writing notes, reviewing notes, doing more research. The process of writing a book like this, in some ways, I think is like writing two books in one, because you have to get all the quotes accurate, you have to get all the facts straight, but then this kind of writing is creative nonfiction or narrative nonfiction, so then you have to write it in a way that's using the techniques of fiction to make it as compelling as you can for the reader. So it's sort of, you know, I'm sort of envious of my friends that just do fiction, because they don't have to worry about whether everything they're saying is true.
So were you writing along the way, like when you got back to your hotel room, would you actually start writing the book, or did you wait until the trip was over before you actually sat down and started writing this?
No, I didn't write along the way, except for the blog posts, which were sort of like mini little chapters. So that, I mean, I was trying to write that in a way that was also compelling and, you know, not just too sloppy. So I was doing some writing there, but no, in terms of the main narrative, that didn't come until, well, I had to write some of it for the proposal, which is a whole process, and then, you know, the rest of the book.
Now, when you say a proposal, a lot of people don't understand what's involved in presenting a nonfiction book to a publisher. What was the process for your proposal?
Right. So when you write nonfiction, one of the nice things versus fiction is you don't have to write the whole book in advance, but you write a proposal, which includes an overview, a section about similar books, a section about how you're going to market it, a section about your own background, sample chapters, and then outlines of the entire book. And I've heard some stories from people who've said, "Oh, I was able to sell my book with only a 15-page proposal." But my first proposal draft, I wrote a proposal before the trip, but then it radically changed after the trip because I knew the story at that point. My proposal was about 125 pages long.
Wow.
Which is an enormous,
it's like half the book.
Right. And so, which my agent didn't seem too concerned about. So I said, okay, well, you know, I'm going to keep doing this. And then it was a matter of, so we went out with that to a few publishers, got some feedback and some rejections, and then reshaped the whole thing again. And then went out again, much more broadly. And when you're doing that, you have an agent who is then pitching the proposal to editors at publishers, and they either, if they want to acquire the book, they'll make an offer with an advance, or not. And so that's the process. And you know, ideally, you're getting as much of a deal as you can. And then when you get an advance, as a writer, you don't see any money on royalties until the publisher has made all of that advance back.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that kind of surprised me was the absence of contemporary pictures, either of the players themselves or with you and the players. Was that a conscious decision?
Well, it was more of a financial decision. I mean, it was pretty clear to me that the publisher, it would be too expensive to include those photos beyond the cards. So I just sort of assumed, okay, well, we're not going to have that. And, you know, but now that I've thought about it more, I kind of like it. People sometimes criticize or say, oh, you should really have pictures. But I like the fact that it's left to your imagination and your curiosity, what these guys look like or what I look like, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, with the internet now, you can just Google these people and find them if you want to. So I've never been a huge picture, probably to my own detriment. My friends always say, you know, if I use Instagram more, I'd probably sell a lot more books. But, I like the role of the imagination in the book.
And now tell me what it was like when you received the final copy of the book.
The actual
printed book. What was that like for you?
That was... Well, I got about 30 of them at once because that was from the publisher. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool. My first reaction was how I just kept thinking about how it looked like a bunch of packs, like oversized giant packs of cards, which brought me back to childhood. And I really, you know, I just was really excited, that nostalgia of like, because I can remember just seeing the packs in the store or on Christmas morning and just getting that rush of excitement. So there was that feeling. And then I think, you know, when you the whole process has been 6 years, and when you spend that much time and you have that much rejection and that much doubt and your, you know, days when you're ready to give up, to sort of have all of that emotion and wrapped up in a single tangible 6x9 object is cool. And I just found myself kind of like absentmindedly flipping through the book, holding it, looking at it, because it was this object that represented so much more.
Looking back on it, was all the work you put into it and all the highs and all the lows, was this an enjoyable thing, or did it become a burden that you just felt you had to push through and get done?
Oh, no, completely enjoyable. I think the fact that I was always motivated by my reason for doing this is not to become a famous writer or not to become rich and famous. It's because this, as a friend of mine said, this book was inside of me and it had to come out. And I think if that's your motivation if you're a creative type and that's your motivation, then it's going to be an enjoyable process, because what's important is that you see it through and you are enjoying the process. You know, people ask me now, well, what's your next book, or what do you want to do next? And I have ideas, but I really don't want to answer that question, because one of the themes of the book itself is this idea. And I, you know, I say in the book that baseball players are accidental Buddhists, because the skill that they have, and may not have even realized it, is the ability to really live in the present moment and what's right in front of them and forget what just happened and not worry about tomorrow. And so for me, as this is my first book, as I go through and the book comes out April 1st and I'm going on a book tour and all this, I want to enjoy every facet of the process. And even where I've, you know, probably been a pain in the ass to my publisher, because I wanted to know, I love learning. I want to know everything about it. How does the book get put together? I actually flew to the Nebraska and met with all the different people that work on the book, because I just wanted to know how do you decide what paper to use? How do you, you know, that curiosity. I mean, that's really what drives me in everything I do, is curiosity. It's not, you know, that's the underlying theme. And so for me, the whole process is enjoyable. And yeah, I mean, there's moments when you get tired and frustrated, but on the whole, I feel really happy and lucky that I was able to actually do this thing, which is such a weird, crazy, out of the box idea, to be able to actually do it.
Was there a lot of back and forth editing wise? Or was it fairly clean and didn't require a whole lot of care and mending?
No, I mean, I thought it was a very light edit from the publisher. I sometimes worried how light it was. Like, you know, I think every writer needs a really thorough edit. But, you know, they did a good job. I think more of the editing early in the process, my first agent was really hard on me in a good way, that said, you know, really just stress test me and said, you know, you have to do better. This has to be more compelling, you know. So that put me through the ringer pretty well. But it ended up producing a better product.
Was there anything between you and the publisher that you came to loggerheads over, or you pretty much accepted everything that they suggested?
Well, there were times when I, as someone new to the process, I didn't really know what the expectations were. So, like I said, I was very, and I continue to be very, or want to be very proactive in the process. So there may have been times when they were frustrated or disagreed with, you know, why am I wanting to be so involved? But it's just because I am curious and I wanted to be part of the process. And so it's been overall a very positive, very smooth experience with the publisher. No major. I was actually really grateful that, and I've been told by other people that have published with the big five publishers, that it's unusual that you can keep your own title or have any say into some of the marketing. And Nebraska, you know, the title of the book is the same title that I had from day one. So
I think that's pretty much, you know, because like you say, the big five really want to make the money, and they take a more control than a university press might or an independent press might. More willing to work with the author and leave the author alone in that regard. Do you keep in touch with any of the players?
Yeah, actually, I'm down in Phoenix for spring training right now, and I had lunch yesterday with Don Carmen. He's down here. And a fun thing, if people go to waxpackbook.com/tour, I'm going on this insane road trip to promote the book and to sign copies and talk about it. And what's really cool is Lee Mazzilli, Gary Templeton, Don Carmen, Rance Mullenix, Al Cowan's family, Purvis and Billy Cowens, are all going to make appearances with me
at
these events. Mm-hmm. So that means a lot to me. And Jaime Coconauer also. The fact that these guys are willing to come back out and do this to me means that they must appreciate the work that I did.
Well, it must be bittersweet for some of these guys are still in the game in one way or another, coaching or other connections with baseball. But it must be like these players, even players like Coconauer and Mullenix, were, like you say, they were the everyman player. They were the utility guy. They were not the all-star. So they must like being in the spotlight again. It must be nice for them.
I think so. I think that they appreciate it. You know, I mean, even though they've been out for a while, it is interesting. These guys, Jaime Coconauer, I was at his house. He still gets every week probably 5 to 6 letters from fans asking them to autograph their cards. So even the most obscure players still have a taste of that fame.
It turned out well. You said Don Carmen was your favorite player, and you were able to get him in the pack. But there's something I heard once about, you know, be careful about meeting your heroes.
Yeah.
And I've seen a number of TV shows, like family sitcoms, where the young kid is a fan of, like, a rock star or something, and they meet him, and it turns out to be a total jerk.
Right.
So you're lucky that was not the case.
Right, and I've also had the other experience, and I've thought about someday writing about this, where I make a brief mention in the book that 15 years ago, I tried my first book attempt was writing about my favorite professional wrestler as a kid, the Iron Sheik, who was, you know, big famous with Hulk Hogan and all those guys, and I quit my job in a magazine and moved to suburban Atlanta to spend a couple months with him, and it was as great as the Don Carmen experience was. That was the exact opposite, and just a complete. I mean, really, it's worth. I should write about it because it's hard to believe it's true that he was. He's a fascinating character and a very complex person. But really, when I met with him, he was still had a lot of drug addiction issues, and I was driving him to crack hotels, and he was threatening to kill me. And night and day with Don Carmen.
You're like Al Stump to Ty Cobb.
Right, right.
All right, I want to do a little rapid fire here before we wrap up. You ready?
Okay.
My favorite player going into the project.
My favorite player going in was Don Carmen.
My favorite player coming out.
Still Don Carmen.
Okay. Biggest pleasant surprise.
The vulnerability, the openness of these guys to talk about their lives.
Biggest disappointment?
Biggest disappointment. I think not getting Gary Pettis. I really would have liked to talk to Gary Pettis.
Because given all the effort you put into meeting Carlton Fisk.
Right. Well, Pettis, so the reason why I say that about Pettis is because he went to the school that I taught at. When I took the trip, I was teaching at Laney College in Oakland, and he grew up in Oakland, and he went to Laney. Went to Laney as a ball player, and he's a guy. So I have that Oakland connection, and also he kind of again is one of these guys that didn't have all the raw. I mean, he got cut from two junior college teams in college, and was not by any means a sure thing. And yet, you know, he won I think 5 Gold Gloves. And was a pretty successful player, and so I would have really liked to. And also because you know he is a guy that got so close with the '86 Angels, would have liked to talk about that.
Favorite baseball book?
Favorite baseball? That's a good question. Let me think.
We'll do two. We'll do fiction and nonfiction. So start off with fiction.
You know, I don't know that I have a favorite baseball fiction book. I haven't really read many. Okay. I would say probably my favorite baseball book is Boys in Summer. And I would say my favorite, this is a bit of a tangent, but my favorite book of all time, it's not baseball, but it's football, a book called Bringing the Heat by Mark Bowden about the 92 Philadelphia Eagles. I think, now that's my ultimate like literary prize is that book. I think.
Well, you have that Philadelphia connection.
Yeah, exactly.
And finally, baseball movie.
Baseball movie. So I get so much flack for saying this, but I really like For Love of the Game.
Okay.
Which, you know, I know it's not the classic that everyone wants to say, you know, Field of Dreams or Major League. And I think Moneyball is fantastic as a movie. But For Love of the Game, I just, you know, it's sappy, but I really like that story.
And for those who are unfamiliar, this is another Kevin Costner baseball vehicle where he's a pitcher winding down his career on a kind of, I don't know if cliched is the right word, but a note like that. We've been talking
the baseball scenes in that movie, even if you don't like the movie, like, are like some of the best if you actually just watch the baseball part.
Yeah, they talk about actors who should not really be in athletic roles, and they talk about Liam Bendix. The alarm clock's going off. I'm in my wife's office, and she's a big frog lover. So
I'm a frog fan too.
So we're gonna apologies to everybody for this one more time. Okay, I usually take the clock out when I'm doing an interview, but I forgot today. So they talk about athletes, actors who should not be athletes. William Bendix in the Babe Ruth story, Tony Perkins in Fear Strikes Out. John C. Reilly is the catcher in that particular movie. Never did it for me.
Yeah. Great actor, not great baseball player.
No. We've been talking with Brad Baluchian, the author of The Wax Pack on The Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Brad, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was our baseball conversation with Brad Baluchian. Come back again next time. You'll find out when, and we'll have another fascinating personage from the world of baseball pop culture. In the meantime, I just want to give you a little heads up on some of the things I'm looking at these days. There are a lot of books. This is a time of year when baseball books are coming out. Unfortunately, the current situation has been plaguing real-life bookstores. You can surely get these things on Amazon and other online merchants, but I miss being able to go to the bookstore and actually pick up and thumb through a book. So a couple of the things I'm looking at right now, and I don't want to do injustice to all the wonderful people who sent me their books to look at, but right now one of the things I'm looking at is Baseball Card Vandals, which is based on a website by a couple of the Abbott brothers, whose first names I do not have at my fingertips right now, unfortunately. But it's based on an online site where they take baseball cards and literally vandalize them. Yep. Another book that's also fun is a book from Chronicle about the incredible women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And Chronicle does a very entertaining job in putting their books together. They're great graphics and little factoids along with the regular story. Another one on a more somber note is, bear with me one second while I grab, I'm juggling a bunch of different devices here between my laptop, my Kindle, my cell phone. But another book I'm looking at right now is War Fever, which is about the Red Sox and the America and baseball in the shadows of the end of World War II. And unfortunately, another thing that we were suffering through then was the Spanish flu. So there are a fair amount of parallels. I'm sure I haven't really gotten into that one too far yet, but World War I has always been one of my favorite topics. So in the meantime, if you have any questions or concerns or suggestions, please drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com and check back on the site regularly. I mean, even though I'm not posting a lot of these conversations as regularly as I would like, I am trying to update the site more often. So that's about it for now. Take care, everybody. Be healthy. Stay sane, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Deaf and boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.